for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama released his revised strategy to reduce drug use and its consequences yesterday. Joining us to talk about the administration's changes in drug policy in the studio, John Walters. He's former director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy under President George W. Bush. Vonda Felbaugh-Brown of the Brookings Institution and Peter Reuter of the University of Maryland. Joining us by phone is Gil Kerlikowske. He's the current director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Please join us with questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. And Gil Kerlikowske, I'd like to start with you. Please tell us what has been changed in the strategy to deal with drug control policy.
Diane, thank you for having me.
Certainly. And,
three other people that you have are people that I've known and respect a great deal. But here are some of the differences that we're dealing with. We're taking head on, for example, something that has not been widely talked about, and that is drugged driving. People driving under the influence of illicit or an illicit substance can be quite concerning, and we need to be addressing that. Secondly is in the area of prescription drugs. We need to have a much greater focus on the prescription drug problems that are existing within the United States. And thirdly, I would tell you that we have a very intense focus and attention to the areas of prevention and treatment, and we're trying our best not to just look at this as a criminal justice or public safety problem, the drug problem, but to also look at it as a public health problem and bring them to the forefront more than they have been.
All right. And Gil, we're having just a little bit of problem with your line, so we're going to hang up and call you back very, very quickly. That's Gil Kerlikowske. He is the current director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, and we'll be talking about the administration's approach to drug control issues and how they may have changed from those of the last administration. And we'll get Mr. Kerlikowske back on the panel as quickly as possible. I wonder, from your perspective, John Walters, where you see the differences between what the current administration has decided with the approach of the prior administration.
Well, I applaud all these initiatives, and I think they're extensions of what needs to be done. I don't think we need to argue about, you know, what's novel here. Their drug driving is a problem, prescription drug abuse is a problem, and everybody's for prevention and treatment. When President Bush gave his first State of the Union message, he started out by talking about a treatment initiative. We all know that diversion programs and drug courts are great. So I think the follow-through on what has been important and successful programs is a credit to the administration. I've written that, and I believe it.
So you don't see any differences then between what was and what's being proposed?
Well, I don't think we had a disagreement with any of these issues. We did. We worked on all of them, and I think there are other issues, obviously international issues about violence and drug control. There are issues about typical drugs of abuse that are more common, heroin, marijuana, cocaine, methamphetamine. So those are followed through, but the administration is also addressing those in its programs, and so I think I applaud them on following through on what's working and pushing on areas of need.
John Walters. He's Executive Vice President of the Hudson Institute. He was Director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy under the George W. Bush administration. And Gil Krulikowski, I gather we have you back on a better line.
Yes, Diane, I'm back with you.
I'm so glad. You talked about the whole effort to control the use of drugs as far as driving is concerned, as far as prescription drugs, prevention, publication. Talk about the goals of your strategy, specifically outline for us your five-year goals.
Well, the five-year goals are very ambitious. One is to reduce the prevalence or the rate of drug use among youth by 15% over 5 years. Now, remember, we will be measured on that every year as we move forward. We also want to reduce the number of deaths as a result of drugs in this country, and those goals are stated throughout the report. And the incidence or the amount of drugged driving, which we talked about just briefly, is also very important for us to reduce that. And those are three of the primary goals. But we have a number of really ambitious things that we want to accomplish with this drug strategy, and we'll only do it by working together.
Do you think that your goals are realistic?
We do. We think that the goals are realistic. If we figure out how we can do a better job of collaborating and cooperating with state and locals. And the reason I tell you that is that I spent a long, long time as a police chief. And this country has, in the last decade, been very successful at reducing crime. And I believe that's a result of incredible partnerships and collaborations that were virtually unheard of 10 years ago. We have never applied that same methodology to drugs, where treatment professionals, prevention programs, and law enforcement are essentially seamless and supportive of each other.
What about the U.S. demand for drugs, Gil? That seems to be what's driving everything here.
We have an incredible appetite for drugs in the United States, and you're very much right. There are two things going on. One is that whether it was in Secretary Clinton's remarks over a year ago or just recently, recognizing that reducing our own demand in the country is important, not just for us, but our international relationships, and that reducing our own demand is a shared responsibility. So it isn't just an advertising campaign or just the responsibility of teachers or just the responsibility of parents. We know that kids will be prevented from using drugs when they get consistent, reliable messages from trusted people early on and throughout up until their late teenage and years.
And further than that, however, I am wondering how you plan to deal with those who are already addicted. What kinds of treatment programs is the administration suggesting beyond what's already out there, and is there enough money?
Well, first of all, there are about 12,000 treatment programs in the United States. Here's the difficulty. Many of them are very small. We're not always sure that they are doing evidence-based treatment. Many of them do not have anything from computers. Many of them do not employ medical personnel. So we need to do a better job of purchasing treatment. And this doesn't mean that these aren't dedicated, and oftentimes there are people in recovery that are very dedicated people to this issue. So we need to be smarter about how we purchase treatment. And here's how we're doing it. The massive change in healthcare is tremendously helpful to us on this issue, because it can help to bring treatment for drug addiction into primary healthcare and not as a separate standalone.
That sounds good. However, there are an awful lot of people out there who perhaps might not even seek treatment. How do you hope to get to them?
Well, you're actually very correct about that, that there are about 20 million people that meet the diagnostic criteria for addiction or dependence. And many of them, it isn't a question of treatment not being available. It's a question that they don't actually seek treatment. So we have a program, and John Walters is to be credited for this, called ESPRT, Screening, Brief Intervention, Referral to Treatment. We all have trusted healthcare professionals that people see. And if that healthcare professional, when he or she is treating you for a broken finger, for example, and they ask you questions about substance abuse and alcohol use, they can, depending on your answers, make a very quick determination that, you know what, you may need further review. And if we know something about addiction, and if we get the treatment to them early, if we make the intervention early, it can often be more successful, it is less timely, and it is less costly.
Of course, you're also there trying to delve into prescription drug use, which makes a big difference.
It does, and I've seen the difficulties. I was just at Morehouse College last week, where I was so impressed with the training that doctors are receiving. Every one of the 4 years that those young doctors are going through medical school, they are given information about addiction and information about pain management. We are working closely with other hospitals and other groups to make sure doctors have the information they need.
Gil Kerlikowske, he's director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. We'll get to the rest of our panel when we return. And we're back talking about the administration's new approach to drugs and a drug control policy. On the line with us is Gil Kerlikowske. He's director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Here in the studio, John Walters. He was in the George W. Bush administration as director of the same office from December 2001 to January 2009. Vanda Felbaugh-Brown is foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institution, and she's the author of a book titled Counterinsurgency and the War on Drugs. Peter Reuter is professor in the School of Public Policy and the Department of Criminology at the University of Maryland. We do invite your calls, your questions. We have several messages from Facebook. The first regarding the so-called war on drugs. And Gil Kerlikowske, I'd like to have your reaction to that phrase. The war on drugs seems to have failed. How do you see it?
Well, I tried to end the war on drugs the first week that I was in office, May of last year. I think that when we continue to talk about a war on drugs, it concerns people that it's a war on them. And I think it also, the phrase limits our ability to use other tools, some of which I mentioned earlier, like the public health tools that come to the forefront. The other difficulty with talking about it with a war metaphor is that, frankly, we've been using war on drugs for about 40 years. There are people that that clearly see it as a failed war and therefore think that the only answers to the problem are legalization, and that is a non-answer.
Peter Reuter, do you believe that the goals as outlined by Gil Kerlikowske are feasible?
They're probably feasible. I think nobody knows whether they will be attained. There's nothing that connects the programmatic and policy interventions to that 15% reduction. On the prevalence, the reduction in the percentage of the population that uses, the Bush administration actually had more ambitious and policies of 25% reduction. The figures are somewhat down. I think 15% is perfectly reasonable. What's really interesting is that they've identified the number of deaths as a target for policy. And that's, I think, a major step forward in realizing we don't just have a problem of drug use, but we have a problem of drug-related mortality and morbidity, and that is a principal target for this administration. 15%, we have no idea what drives these things, so it's a perfectly reasonable number, but there's nothing that connects it to the
now,
program.
Now, here's a message from Facebook from Ariel, who said we should also discuss the violent effects of our war on drugs on other countries. How many countries have gone the way of Colombia or Mexico because we continue to demand the complete repression of illicit drug production and transport? Vanda.
Well, it is our demand, more so than our war on drugs or counter-narcotics efforts, that, of course, drive supply around the world. We also need to recognize that we are not the only consuming country in the world, and more we are not the most intensely consuming country in the world. Brazil, Argentina now have prevalence use on the par or even greater than the United States. In Pakistan, Afghanistan, the addiction rates and use rates are probably greater. However, the question identifies a very important part of the problem, which is that far too often our counter-narcotics policies abroad have solely focused on repression, on forced eradication, and on interdiction. Nominally, other approaches like drug treatment and socioeconomic investments and investment in the judicial systems were also part of the policies, but they have often been the afterthought, thrown there to sort of pacify the publics, the critics, with very limited funding. And one of the very positive things about the new strategy released is that it indeed emphasizes very strongly the need for socioeconomic programs for addressing rule of law in these countries. In fact, one of the striking sentences in the report was that eradication needs to be accompanied by alternative livelihoods. Not that it simply should be, but it needs to be. Now, that is often not part of our source country policies, such as in Colombia, but it's very much now part of the strategy in Afghanistan.
And what about Mexico? This new approach is being released just prior to the visit to the United States at Felipe Calderon. I wonder about Mexico.
Well, Mexico is another very positive development. Over the past several weeks, the Obama administration has released the follow-up to Merida called Beyond Merida, and it includes some vast improvements on the previous strategies and improvements that have now serious buy-in from the Mexican administration. And again, it emphasizes not simply technological transfers and intelligence and military training, but much more focus on building civilian capacity in terms of police, justice, indeed, it was part of Merida, the previous Merida as well, but much less emphasized, and critically also focus on the socioeconomic conditions of communities that are very susceptible to being lured either into illegal or informal economies in Mexico. And this now fourth component, the new fourth pillar, building resilient communities, is, in my view, one of the best improvements in Merida. Unfortunately, it also gets the least funding under the new budget.
Peter Reuter, you're not sure that this does much to help the influx of drugs from Mexico?
No. I think that everything in Merida is about helping Mexico deal with the violence and corruption around the drug trade. And I think that's entirely appropriate because that is Mexico's drug problem. In terms of what it does for us, for the United States, it does very little. It's certainly not going to reduce the flow of cocaine, heroin, and marijuana. Indeed, you know, I think it's quite reasonable to say that if we manage to establish peace in Mexico in the drug trades, that there will be a smoother flow of drugs into the United States. That's probably what happened in Colombia in the early 1990s after the crackdown by the Colombian government.
John Walters, there is a portion of this new approach which talks about strengthening international relationships in order to try to build a better understanding of what's happening between our countries and others in regard to drugs. Do you think it goes far enough?
I think it has to start with prevention, which was what we started with in regard to demand. And the one thing I have been critical of the administration about is the failure of President Obama to use his enormous charisma with young people to speak directly about this issue. He wasn't at the release. He hasn't talked about drugs seriously. He has talked about his own personal experience with drugs, which gives him enormous credibility, I think, especially with young people, especially with, I would say, African-American males who are huge victims of this problem. And he would be as powerful, I believe, today, and maybe more powerful than Nancy Reagan was during the Reagan administration. I'd like to see that, because if we're going to talk seriously about prevention, we have to remember that kids are bombarded with messages to use drugs. Type marijuana into YouTube. Type pharmaceuticals. They're encouraged to use them. And so if we don't push back, the force is to encourage them to experiment.
Gil, I'm interested in why the president himself has not spoken out more forcefully.
Let me tell you this, that I have had access to the president since the day I walked into office. There's another important component to all of this, and that is the person that created the Office of National Drug Control Policy, one of the persons, was then Senator Biden. And so to have now Vice President Biden as a strong supporter and ally on this issue is very, very important. I could also tell you that that as the president has had so many issues, as we all know, in front of him, that he has been engaged in the issue with me on the drug policy and that he is supportive. I mean, this is his policy. And I am very confident that in the future he will be able to devote a little more time to the importance of this. Now, he also recognizes, of course, in his support for education, the drug issue is involved in keeping kids in school. It's involved in health care, et cetera.
Our thoughts, as you have mentioned, the vice president, our thoughts go out to him and his son, Beau, who has suffered a stroke and is being hospitalized. I'd like to understand the emphasis here on prescription drugs, Gil Krulikowski. I understand that it's America's fastest growing drug problem, and driving is a huge problem with prescription drugs.
It is. The increase in drug overdose fatalities is in the last few years is largely driven by prescription drugs.
But young people are also getting hold of these prescription drugs.
And that's actually who I'm talking about. It isn't certainly older people that have misused them. It is young people who abuse and become addicted to these drugs. And they get them, of course, through the medicine cabinets of their parents. The other dangerous part about, particularly about these prescription drugs, is that young people do not perceive them as dangerous. They say that I'm not buying it in a piece of tin foil from behind a gas station. It's a prescription. It came out of my parents' medicine cabinet or my grandmother's medicine cabinet. And that's these are many troubling aspects. And, of course, we've seen the pill mills or the so-called pain clinics in South Florida that have just proliferated in number and in the amount of prescriptions that are being written by doctors who really, in my estimation, are not following proper practice.
John Walters, does the law enforcement part of this approach go far enough, in your view?
On prescription drugs?
Not only on prescription drugs, but the whole drug approach.
I think that we have to emphasize both supply and demand. Treatment is important, and you're right. The central issue is getting people in, and that's why I think diversion programs in the criminal justice system that break the cycle are important, as well as screening, as the director said. But on the law enforcement side, I think we have been a little slow to use the various partners, but have specific information about these markets. We have reduced, and Peter and I have a debate about this on the side, but we have reduced the availability of some key drugs. Mm-hmm. We've done that with LSD. We've done that with methamphetamine. We've done that with some aspects of heroin coming from Colombia. And I think we've done that with cocaine as well, although that's where Peter and I may disagree. But I think you see the change. You see the radical improvement in Colombia, which is a combination of domestic reform and reducing the money machine that funded some of the violent groups. Mexico wants to do that. So I think you have to make sure that these poisons don't continue. That reinforces prevention and treatment options. And I think we can do that, but we need to have more specific information as we do with other kind of attacks on network phenomena. And we have to break down specific parts. This is an organized, networked criminal activity at the high end, and you can do a better job. You've done things like the crime change in the United States in New York City by focusing on real-time data, figuring out who the perpetrators are. And I would pair even demand reduction efforts to bring treatment to areas as you bring law enforcement, so you help people who now may not be able to find their drugs get into treatment when they're more willing. We were trying to do that when I was in the office. I think data is beginning to allow us to do that, and our understanding, we need to go further fast.
John Walters, the Hudson Institute. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
Thank you. The question I have is if anything is done in this program to address the overprescribing by physicians and other health practitioners of certain classes of prescription drugs, such as diazepines, including Valium and Klonopin.
Gil Kerlikowski.
Yes, there are several things. One, and I had mentioned working with medical schools, so that doctors can get the information that they need. Quite frankly, the amount of information a young doctor gets about addiction and about pain management is not very much, and so we're working with them. We also have had meetings with the Joint Commission for Accreditation of Hospitals and talk with them about how accreditation standards can be applied.
All right, to Chicago, Illinois. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling because in working peripherally in the field, I see that the treatment centers that are there, there's a lot of good intention and a lot of resources into the, you know, put into to drug treatment, but the success rate is extremely low and the failure rate is extremely high. And in looking at research, there's very little validity and reliability, and that one program that shows success is rarely replicated when it's produced by another program and researched. And that if we look at the failure rate, and if we look at this as a medical treatment, we would go back to the drawing board because there's such a high failure rate.
All right, Peter Reuter.
It's true that most people who enter drug treatment for the first time will fail to complete the first line of treatment, even if they succeed in completing the first treatment episode or the first treatment events, they'll relapse. And even so, drug treatment is enormously cost-effective because when heroin or cocaine users are using their drugs intensively, they are causing huge social costs, both to people around them and more generally. When they're in treatment, they rarely desist entirely, just the reduction in drug use has huge social benefits. So treatment can easily defend itself as being a very cost-effective intervention, even though the caller is entirely right that most fail in the treatment.
Why do most fail?
Well, it's the standard version is it's a chronic relapsing lifetime condition, and that does describe it.
Peter Reuter, he's professor in the School of Public Policy and the Department of Criminology at the University of Maryland. Gil Kurlikowski, I understand you have to leave us at this point.
I do, Diane, and thank you for having me.
And thank you so much for joining us. The White House Office of National Drug Control Policy.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news and politics, culture and lifestyle at Germany.info, by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org, and by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
A behind-the-scenes look at America's $17 billion pet food industry, what you need to know about the nutritional needs of your dog or cat. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Panel on the new drug policy statement from the White House is now down to two. John Walters, who was the former director of the White House Office on National Drug Control Policy, also had to leave us, along with Gil Kurlikowski, the current director. We'll go now to the phones to Mike, who's in Washington, D.C. Good morning to you.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. I had originally called to ask Director Kurlikowski a question, but I guess since former Director Walters is on the line, I'll ask him now.
No, I'm sorry. Former Director Walters has already left. Let's have your question.
Well, my question is going to be about the Drugs Czar report released yesterday, and
basically why it overstated long-debunked claims about the harms of marijuana while not having any mention whatsoever about the harms of marijuana prohibition, specifically how it's been fueling those Mexican drug cartels you were talking about before. By former director's Walter's own estimation, the drug cartels make more than 60% of their profits from marijuana trade.
All right. Peter Reuter.
The call is right that that this strategy, like previous strategies, lists all the harms of marijuana and is silent about the consequences of marijuana enforcement. Marijuana is an addictive drug. It does cause various problems. A surprising number of people who start using it do, in fact, go on to become dependent on it. The dependence isn't nearly as serious as it is for cocaine or alcohol, but it is serious, and our the fact that we have a prohibited market and can't grow it legally does mean that Mexico supplies it, and there are bad consequences to that. The other thing that the strategy doesn't talk about, and in this it continues a 20-year tradition, is that we arrest 800,000 people for simple possession of marijuana each year. And I think that that's a serious problem of itself. We have good reason to be skeptical that those arrests do any good, and we certainly know that they cause, they have bad consequences of the people arrested, many of whom are, in fact, otherwise law-abiding young people.
Vanda.
What I would add to what Peter was saying is that there is a sort of misconceived notion out there that if there were no illegal commodities, there would be no crime organizations. So if the United States legalized drugs, there would be no crime in the U.S. or elsewhere. That's, of course, not the case. In fact, many crime organizations participate in extortion of legal businesses and in smuggling with legal commodities like cigarettes. It's a very important part of the drug market in Mexico, for example. So the issue really is, how do we manage our regulation, be it on the legal side or on the illegal side, and how do we manage crime? And the big problem for Mexico, of course, is that its law enforcement has become, after decades of de facto corporatist arrangement with the drug trafficking organization, deeply eviscerated, hollowed out, and corrupt by the traffickers, and unable to conduct the level of enforcement and the quality of enforcement that takes place in Western Europe, that takes place in the United States.
All right, to Temple Pines, Florida. Oscar, you're on the air. Oscar. Yes, go right.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Yeah. My comment is how effective can be the prevention and education programs for the youth when many parents don't consider that the use of drugs or experimenting with drugs is that dangerous? To start with the top, the last two presidents, including the current one, experimented with drugs in their youth. And so I remember Karen many years ago in one of your programs calling and rebuking one of your guests, saying that he had a teenager daughter and he was helping her experimenting with drugs. So first thing we have to start with re-educating the parents before trying to educate the youth.
All right. Thanks for your call, Peter.
The OND, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, has this national ad campaign, and it has a very interesting new ad which emphasizes that many of the parents who are talking to children about drug use are themselves people who had extensive histories of marijuana use. And it deals directly with the problems that they may have in talking about it. Now, I don't entirely agree with the specific strategy that they use there, but I think that it's a much more candid approach to this issue than has been tried before.
Vanda.
Again, Peter touched on a very important issue, which is the content of messaging for prevention or even for getting people into treatment. I mean, when I teach my students at Georgetown, I frequently ask them, have you gone through their programs and did you think they were effective? Did they discourage you? And uniformly, I said no. I get the answer no. I ask nothing about whether they used drugs, but whether they thought that the school program, that their program was effective. And one of the key things that we learned is that for prevention of any chronic illness, be it cigarette use or obesity, needs to be very much targeted to the specific social group and understand the interests and values of the group. So basing messages on long-term consequences for society might be something that really doesn't resonate with teenagers. Focusing messages like the Montana Meth campaign did on what matters to teenagers, being able to date girlfriends and boyfriends, was a very effective campaign because that was an issue that mattered.
All right, to Hamilton, New Jersey. William, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. The comment I wanted to make, first of all, in my younger days, I have sold drugs, in particular marijuana. The reason I sold it was because I used it, for one, and the other reason was because there was money involved. Now, as far as what you said about, not you, but somebody up there said about cigarettes are legal and there's still money to be made from illegal activities involved. And I don't doubt that, but the point is that I didn't sell cigarettes because you could go buy cigarettes. You know, they were legal. And it's a multifaceted problem, I'm sure, and there's no single answer that's going to cover every issue of this, every part of this problem. But I think that the reason there's so much violence is because of the money, and the reason there's so much money is because it's illegal.
William,
I'm not saying legalize everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, look at the marijuana part.
Now, are you still selling drugs?
No, ma'am. That was back in my younger days. I've matured a lot, and there was too much risk involved.
How much money did you make?
I made quite a bit. I mean, I didn't buy a house or anything else like that, but, you know, it was enough where I didn't have to work.
But the point was that you started using drugs, and then in order to feed the habit, you began selling them?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that last part.
Okay. You started using drugs, and then because you were using drugs, you began selling them as well?
I began using drugs, and I began selling drugs because I realized how much money was involved. I mean, if you go to the store and you could buy a pack of pre-rolled marijuana cigarettes, then there's no need to go to the drug dealer down the street. You know, if you can buy that for $5 at a liquor store or someplace like that, there's no reason to go down to the street and contact a dealer and have to pay $50.
And tell me how old you were when you started using drugs and selling drugs.
I think I was about 17, 16 or 17 when I started using marijuana. And I did it until I stopped pretty much all of that when I got in my 30s.
I gather you also sold hash.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Vonda, you wanted to make a comment.
I mean, the caller is not only impressively honest, but also right, that of course it's the criminal aspect that brings the money in. It is the criminal tax that makes cultivating coca or poppy or selling it on U.S. streets so extremely profitable. However, the mere fact that something is profitable does not necessarily drive crime, nor does it necessarily drive the violence in crime, nor is the appropriate response then to, say, legalize in order to deprive crime of its existence. I mean, enriched uranium is extremely valuable commodity to smuggle on the black market. The appropriate reaction should not be that we legalize smuggling with enriched uranium, which can be then used for nuclear weapons or radiological weapons, in order to deprive certain crime entities of the financial profits from it. Of course, that's not the appropriate reaction. I mean, similarly, being a murderer, not in Mexico, but in many places, an assassin, a competent assassin, is a very profitable business. The answer is not we should legalize murder or say that protection of life is now up to private entities.
Peter.
The caller's experience is really quite a normal one. I mean, think about the
normal,
American...
Normal, but... illegal.
Oh, absolutely illegal. But, I mean, there are probably a couple of million people who are selling marijuana any year. I mean, and the American University dormitories are full of local dealers, and they probably make $4,000 or $5,000 a year out of it, and it enables them to buy a better car, and eventually they'll mature out of it. I'm not condoning it, but just saying it's a perfectly normal experience for American adolescents and young adults.
Thanks for calling, William. Let's go to Charlie in Vieques, Puerto Rico. You're on the air, Charlie.
Hello. I'm calling to talk about, I don't think drugs should be legalized because I'm around 60 years old, and most of the people I know and excuse me, who have died from drug overdoses have died during an operation of anesthetic overdoses before they got operated on. So if we make drugs legal and people take as much as they want, there's going to be a lot more deaths than what's already been recorded.
Charlie, I don't think anybody here is talking about making drugs legal. Thanks for calling. To Gainesville, Florida. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. I'd like to make a point of, if we can't really keep drugs out of prison, which is a secured area in which nothing should get in, nothing should get out, and drugs still make it in, how do we ever expect to keep drugs out of a free society?
Indeed, this is, I think, epitomizes that relying on criminalized approach to dealing with drug addiction is not effective. Most people in prisons are in prisons because of drug offenses. Most of them will only end up being more dependent on drugs because of the prison experience. At the same time, treatment is vastly underavailable in prison situations. And focusing on prison settings should be one of the key areas of expanding treatment, as well as diverting people from prisons into prison courts and other mechanisms.
Brenda Vilba Brown, she's adjunct professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Peter, I know you want to make a point.
Yes. I mean, in fact, there's very little drug use in prisons. That's a sort of shocking statement to make. But there are a number of studies where they've done random surveys, you know, unscheduled time, in which they test inmates. And I remember in Arizona, it was something less than 2% tested positive.
Peter, that is indeed a shocking statement.
And I have some facts, and I think you just have to take them seriously. It's not a single study. Repeatedly, you find very low rates of drugs in the urines of prison inmates.
How do you account then for other studies, articles, statements indicating that drug use in prisons is absolutely rampant?
I'm citing certain studies. Yes, I'm citing sort of perfectly conventional kinds of studies that test this hypothesis.
Vande, have you seen such studies as well?
No, indeed, I have not. And, you know, I think that if that's the case, that's very encouraging. It is especially encouraging because treatment is so underprovided. I still maintain, however, that the proper reaction to dealing with addiction or use should not be sending people to prisons unless they have also committed some very serious violent offenses, because it deeply disrupts their lives, it disrupts the lives of communities, it overburdens the state system, etc.
All right, and finally to Rockford, Michigan. Good morning, Erin. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question was whether your panel believes that the direct merchandising of pharmaceutical drugs, prescription medications, to the consumer has fueled a rise in illegal use of prescription drugs, just because so many kids are seeing commercials for medication on television, which to me almost sends a message of, you know, safety and permissiveness.
Peter.
I'd not thought about that, and it sort of sounds quite plausible to me, but I just don't know anything about it.
And Vanda?
I would have the same reaction. I really haven't seen any studies of it. I would think it's plausible. I mean, certainly one of the things we hear about why prescription drugs are on the use is because they are seen as safer and more legal. There is expectation that overdose will not result so easily, and there is expectation that punitive consequences will not result so easily.
Then, finally, what does this plan recommend for Afghanistan?
Well, I'm glad that you asked the question, because that, for me, is one of the most interesting developments of the Obama administration counter-narcotics policy, along with the changes in Merida. It's really a radical shift away from how we have been doing counter-narcotics policies abroad for the past 30 years, which have emphasized über alles eradication. And the Obama administration has appropriately and courageously backed away from ineffective and very counterproductive eradication policies in Afghanistan, has really defunded, and now focuses on interdiction and interdiction of drug traffickers, especially Taliban-linked drug traffickers, and rural development to build legal livelihoods for vast segments of populations that are dependent on poppy cultivation, and then link them to the state, the Afghan state. I don't want to suggest that it's perfect. I have a lot of questions about the operationalization and implementation of the plan. I have some disagreements with what's being done on interdiction. I have questions about the rural program. But at least at the broad strategic level, I think it's a very courageous, very appropriate move, and the Obama administration should get a lot of credit for it.
Vandevelde Brown, she's a foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's also at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. Peter Reuter is professor in the School of Public Policy and the Department of Criminology at the University of Maryland. Thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.